Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to give it up for James Brown, but no, not James Brown. Clyde Stubblefield, who passed away at 73, he was the most sampled drummer in hip-hop history. Everybody sampled his work. He didn't get a dime for it, by the way, from what I've read. But he was James Brown's lead drummer. The man could just put a rhythm out there, which he did. And that sound you heard was a staple in people's lives, dancing and thinking about rhythm. And all the kind of everybody from N.W.A., Dr. Dre, and more all sampled his work, put it in the heart of their work. And he passed away yesterday at 70, this weekend at 73. So farewell to the great Clyde Stubblefield. We thought we'd put that out there for y'all to start the day off with. So we're going to have a local roundtable here, and we'll introduce the guests as they come in. No one's by phone right now, right? I'm trying to get an answer. Yes, no. So we have with us in studio Dana Moore, who's an attorney, community activist, member of the Baltimore City Liquor Board, former chair of the City Ethics Board, past president of Charles Village Civic Association. Good to have you all here. I'm good to have
you
here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. And Louise, so let's begin with just something we've talked about a little bit, which is at least Elijah Cummings' piece and the present. And
yes,
folks, do join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk at steinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do join in. I want to hear your thoughts on, you're going to be touching the school system, on ICE's activities in Baltimore, snatching up Latino people in the city and putting them in prison and sending them off, and a number of issues affecting our city. So join us here at 410-319-8888. But we're going to start off with a city issue, which is our city, one of our two congressmen from Baltimore City, and Elijah Cummings, who was called out by Trump in this press conference saying, I talked to him, and he just said he couldn't talk to me because he was worried about political fallout from it. Thank you, fallout from it. And Elijah said, he never talked to me. I never talked to him. He never talked to me.
Astounding. Totally astounding. Turns out it was, by Congressman Cummings' account, it was a complete falsehood. And we got to ask ourselves, why would the President of the United States of America stand at his very first flying solo press conference, do that? And oftentimes the truth is inconvenient, and oftentimes the truth doesn't put us in the best light, but it's never acceptable for the president to do what he did, and especially with such a revered and respected congressperson. You know, we tell our children, you know, never tell a lie, and certainly don't tell a lie that's so easily refuted. And I think someone should give the president that same message.
I think, you know, he is, I hate to say this, I mean, but he's almost like a congenital liar. I mean, it's like he can't not say things. I mean, even when he had a press conference talking about the Muslim ban, saying, well, look what just happened in Sweden last night. Nothing happened in Sweden. The Swedes are going, what? What are you talking about?
Exactly. I mean, and we all are going to the Google. What's happening in Sweden? Well, guess what? Here's what's happening in Sweden. Absolutely nothing. And we're all left astounded. But I think, we're all watching with great mysticism and wonder, you know, what is this all about? And, you know, a narrative is being put out there that is just so entirely false. But it also, for people that, you know, believe everything that comes out of Washington, D.C., you know, currently the current White House, it stokes fear. There's encouragement to reject the real news, because the real news is just not comfortable for the president right now. I applaud Congressman Cummings and all of the other elected officials that are standing up and saying, oh, no, that's not right. That's not accurate. That's not true. And that are pushing back.
Luis, you on the phone with us? Hi, Luis.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know you were there.
I am.
Hey, Luis, how are you? Luis Lorin, of course, is with us as well. He's leadership organizer for the United Workers. Good to have you with us, Luis.
Thank you. Good to be in the show again.
On every day but Monday, he's walking the halls of Annapolis, trying to get some important bills passed, which we'll talk a bit about here. So, Luis, before we turn into kind of what's happening in our community here locally, what your thoughts on Mr. Trump and his confrontation with Elijah?
Nothing surprising. Unfortunately, it seems like this is the new reality and the new reality that we live on. That the president just woke up and decided that he wants to speak to somebody and to either make something up or just call it out because he wants to. And it's it's of course very scary. You know, like it's kind of like it's one of those things that is funny until it's actually not funny anymore. You know,
right?
Like. Like the first time I was kind of like, oh my God, what's wrong with him? And then then you're yourself to be like, well, something is seriously wrong, and then we need to be concerned, you know, because then we have like from personal confrontations to like target a whole group of people and the population. And so like it's kind of quite scary, like you know, like that's one of those things. Like it's funny until it's not funny anymore. But yeah, I think like unfortunately not surprising that he's. Speaking on the line at this time, you know, and I think like that just speaks to the fact that we need to be stronger and that we need to be more united and like put some resistance to this type of unacceptable behavior, mainly coming from the president.
And I think we also have Edgar Reyes on the phone. He's going to be here in just a few minutes in our studio. Edgar's with us. He's a full-time teacher, off today. He has a day off on President's Day. Glad to have him with us. Artist, activist, formerly undocumented, but now a citizen and here in teaching in our schools. Edgar, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Yes, I am.
Welcome. So you want to give your quick thought on Mr. Trump and Congressman Cummings?
I think for our undocumented community, I think a lot of us are afraid of what's been happening and a lot of the you know kind of nasty stuff that's been directed towards our community. I think we're anxious to see what's going to happen. You know, it's only been what
1 month,
not even a month that this man has been in office. So I think we're waiting to see, but we're also responding to what these, you know, especially Trump, what he's doing and what actions he's asking others to take on.
Yeah, and we've been covering this almost every day with something about the new president and the kind of madness he's thrown at the rest of us, which we'll be covering a great deal more during the coming week. But let me ask you some questions about it in our community, and I'm going to hold off until talk a bit about the what happened with ICE. Snatching up a businessman in the city and sending him to Frederick, Maryland, and we'll be deporting him and what all that means and the sense of what's happening in the city around that. And also, I would love to explore the unity or lack of unity that's happening around this issue between Latino communities and the African-American community in Baltimore and what that portends for a resistance and unity for both, which mm-hmm. I think is important to explore as well. But first, you know, the other thing that I think that is front and center in the city has always been issues around policing and public safety, which we cover a lot in this program. So we spent a lot of time covering what happened with Anthony Anderson back in 2012 when he was killed because he was body slammed by a police officer, and it punctured his pancreas, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. and he died. Mm-hmm. And so they just settled for $300,000. With the city, the three officers, Boyd, Strohm, and Voderick, are still on the force. They said making between $105,000 and $112,000 a year as police officers. In that particular incident, he was confronted. They thought he had some drugs in his mouth. They said he swallowed, but he was surrounded by three police officers, and rather than just grabbing him and arresting him and handcuffing him and putting him in the car, they body slammed him, which is why he died. And it still begs the question, with all the stuff going around with the new commissioner trying to change this behavior and change the nature of how we police in the city. I was thinking about the other night. I emceed something on Friday night at MICA for the folks in Cherry Hill and the Youth Resiliency Institute with Fanon Hill and Navasha Dea, And one of the things in that film they did was that they actually had police coming in to do artwork with young people in the community and begin to build relationships. People think that's kind of silly, but I think just the opposite. Maybe that's what training should be more about, because clearly this lawsuit said something went wrong in the death of Anthony Anderson, like the death of all the others at the hands of the police. So your thoughts, Dana?
So I have two thoughts. One is, what is the psychology that leads to the action that happened to Anthony Anderson? What is the level of the anger and fear that causes police to think that that is the right way to act? And how do we deal with that? There has to be more basic training, but also my understanding is that the police have to go through psychological evaluation. There was a whole issue with the company that was doing that, that would do evaluations in 20, 30 minutes instead of the hours. That's being resolved. But there's that whole psychological component. But I very much support anything that breaks down the barriers between the police and youth, and the police and citizens. And the art program that you described is one of those things. I know that Erica Alston with the Safe Kids Zone organized sports, friendly sports competition between the police and the young scholars. It's hard to body slam somebody that you realize is more your brother than your perpetrator. So I think those programs are a part of the solution.
Edgar, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is not new, in particular when we talk about not just police officers, but we think about ICE. I mean, they're racially profiling our community. They're specifically looking for people that look like me, who are brown and look like they speak Spanish. So I think there needs to be a better sense of training for these officers, and also not just to target our community, because there are people who are blonde, blue-eyed, who are overstaying their visas and are illegal.
I just motioned to Mark that when you said that they're targeting people that look Hispanic, well, that could be me. I am no more Hispanic than the table that I'm sitting at, but I look it to some people. And I had an encounter at the Giant grocery store where a woman totally went off on me, and I got back into my car and I said, why would she do that? And I looked at myself in the mirror and I realized, I know I'm African American, I know I'm black, I know who my parents are, but she didn't. She looked at me and she thought, oh, here is this Latina woman who's gotten in line in front of me and I'm not having it. And it was ugly.
Wow.
And this is real. This is real. It's unacceptable. And I pushed back. What I forgot was that I carry a badge now.
Because of the liquor board.
Because of the liquor board. I was like, man, maybe if I'd showed her my badge. But you know what? Why do I even have to go that way? Why? It's crazy.
Luis, you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, of course. Unfortunately, I think... as we've been saying here, it's unfortunately nothing new. The way that the police treat people, and definitely in the Latino community, there's this fear, with ICE, with the new borders, and with Trump saying to ICE, now you will be able to do what you haven't been able to do for years. And that's kind of a really scary thing to say, to be honest, because we know that. ICE has been wanted to be way more aggressive, not necessarily just on systematic enforcement, but also how they act to when they found or when they identify or when they believe that they identify an undocumented person because that person looks like me. It's brown, so it must be a person to target, for no reason, except because it's brown. So I think it's pretty unfortunate, and that's it definitely needs to. There is so much to do, and so much to. I feel like if any time in modern history where we need to come together and really fight together and resist the situation is now, because it's not just ICE attacking Latinos, but then police enforcement with violence on poor communities that are. White people, black people, Latinos, and it's just like to the point that now that is the, again, it's just a new reality. It's the new normal. Like the police is violent to citizens. So the police believe that they can just do that, and there is very little consequences, if any. Therefore, what is the? There is no fear. There is no like mentality like, oh, I shouldn't do this, because there is very little consequences. So I think this is a very important time in history where we need to come together and we really need to fight and try to change and look into the rest of the problems, like why this this thing happens, why is this we have this this situation now. So I think like that's more important than ever for all of us to unite as people.
I agree. What's happening in this sense of fear, and it feels like a closing of borders, but you know, it might be you know, brown people today. It's been black people for many, many, many years. I was just thinking, you know, our motto, land of the free and home of the brave. But if we're not going to be the land of the free, if there's going to be an effort to take that away, then the brave have to step up. And that's all of us. You know, when I read about the one person who was picked up and then sent to Frederick, you know, my thought is, you know, I don't want to be a bystander. I don't want to just stand and watch this happening. And what can I do? And I called the city and said, listen, I want to volunteer. I'm an attorney. I'm not an immigration lawyer. I don't know that law, but I know how to argue. And, you know, the response I got was, well, let's have you sign up to, you know, represent people at I guess, bail hearings, which I can do. But I'd love to stop the whole process. That's not going to happen. I think the process will continue. There's a strong commitment to do that. But we are in it together. There is no question about it. There is no question about it.
So in a few minutes, I do want to talk a bit about city schools. But let me throw this out to you all. And when Edgar gets in the studio, he can jump in on this as well. But, you know, when we talk about the city and what's going on between Black Lives Matter and the demonstrations that have taken place, the demands from people around development and dealing with the poverty and the intense poverty inside the poorest parts of our community here, you know, and when you look at what's happening with ICE in the Latino community here, but there seems to be a disconnect. And maybe I'm wrong about this, but let's explore it. And I want our listeners to chime in at 410-319-8888. And part of that disconnect is between these divides we have in the city, and we live in very separated worlds. And I do think in some ways there's a social and political divide between the African-American and Latino communities in this city, seeing each other antagonistically as opposed to working against one another's interests, jobs, more. And I think that that's something that, you know, you hear it sometimes when people were saying things like when people got upset about the immigration ban and then people being snatched up by ICE, for mostly Latinos, the immigration ban affecting mostly Muslim people in seven countries. But the people's remarks are, well, where was everybody when we were in the streets of Black Lives Matter? Where was everybody when we needed that kind of unity? So I think there's a question here that should be explored. And how do you bridge that gap? Because the only way that kind of power, if you look to also today at our schools, which are mostly African American, but increasingly there are more and more numbers of young Latino kids in Baltimore City public schools. And we see the budget being destroyed and neither the state nor the city coming up with any answers. But unless there's that kind of unity between Latino and the black worlds in Baltimore, very little is going to go ahead.
I concur. One of the signs that I saw from the Women's March that was just still resonates was it said, "Where will all you nice, you know, I expect to see all you nice white women at the next Black Lives Matter rally."
Right.
And it's like DAMMMMM. I mean, there it is. There it is. But we can point fingers and we can divide ourselves forever. But there needs to be a bridge. And if for no other reason, if nothing else, I think the current president can, he's making decisions and forcing issues that really ought to be bringing us together.
Edgar, good to have you in the studio. Welcome. Sorry for all the confusion. Good to have you here.
No, I'm glad I made it. I think for me, what brought me to Baltimore was partly that, right? The fact that Baltimore is shifting in terms of its demographics. We look at Hallandtown. I think within the last, you know, 5 or so years, every year the Latino population's increased almost 120% every year. So I think that merge and that kind of hybrid of understanding the fact that we are two oppressed communities that are facing very similar issues is going to be very significant for our young people to see, especially as we see, you know, the marginalized community that's Latino being pushed more north from the park, and what's predominantly, you know, north of the park has been, you know, Black communities, and we're going to be intersecting even more so. And I think having lived in Los Angeles, having lived in D.C., I think it's very significant that we start bridging now some of these healthy intersections instead of them later on. Hopefully it doesn't happen, but we might start seeing bumping heads and people just, we might see some bigger conflicts arise. And I think it's very significant that, you know, we're having this conversation now, but also we need to broaden it and to ask other organizations to start broadening their outreach in terms of not just the Black community or the African-American community, but also including the Latino voice and vice versa. I think there's a lot of Latino communities starting or existing in Baltimore, and they need to also be inclusive as well.
I mean, I think that I'm thinking about where we are right now with our school system. And one of the things I said about before we went on the air, when Dana and I were sitting here, was that I'm just surprised that given what's happening to our city schools, the majority of our students are African American and come from poor working class communities. There are a lot of Latino kids in our schools now, especially on the east side of Baltimore and in certain high schools in the city. Those numbers are really growing. There are also some white kids in school as well, in certain communities in Hamden, but also in some of the high schools, City Poly and some of our citywide schools. And I'm just surprised that given this budget deficit and the danger of all these people being laid off, the danger of cutting out all art and music, the danger of, I heard last night from a school teacher, cutting out all junior varsity sports from schools could be one of the things they do, that there's not more outrage. That people aren't like in the streets saying, these are our schools, these are our kids. How can we let this happen? I mean, this is huge. I mean, our schools are already, you can argue about the funding and how much funding people get. And this Baltimore City gets more funding on other schools, but we've been getting less and less, and it doesn't take into account the divide between charter and traditional schools going to be affected. It doesn't take into account the needs of our city's kids, whether it's a second language or whether it's because kids live in such dire poverty. And we just seem to be complacent about what's happening to our schools. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Get your ideas on all the things we've been talking about here. Black-Latino unity and that divide. Our city schools may be a place for that unity to come together. What are your thoughts at 410-319-8888? We're going to have a very quick break and come right back with our guests. Don't go away. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us. We're here with Dana Moore, attorney, community activist, member of the Baltimore City Liquor Board, former chair of the City Ethics Board, and past president of Charles Village Civic Association, very involved lady, and Edgar Reyes, who is a full-time teacher, activist, artist, was undocumented. He has no longer, but he's deeply involved in these issues, and Luis Larin, who is leadership organizer with the United Workers. And you all at 410-319-8888. Rachel is here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. We'd like to hear from you, 410-319-8888. Michael, I'm going to come right to your call. I want to hear what our guests think about what I said before we went to break. Your thoughts.
You go first.
I think it's a very loaded question, right? And I think what happens a lot with my community, I mean the undocumented community, it's not just Latinos. I think we don't know our rights. We don't know what we should and shouldn't have, right? So sometimes it just seems normal not to have access to things. And it's partly of just educating people and just knowing, like, you should have access to this. And also asking the city to not just funnel our students to go to specific high schools, right? And you see that, right? You go to Patterson High School, and there's a big ESL, English as a Second Language teachers right. there, right. right? You look at, I'm spacing out the other high school, the one in the harbor.
Digital Harbor,
right? And it's the same thing, right? And I think people not knowing the fact that each school at least should have resources for each student, right? But I think the city is, you know, lack of money, lack of resources, is funneling kids to these two high schools. Of course, there's others that I'm missing, but I think it's lack of knowing what they should have access to. And I think we are seeing people organize. We are seeing people go out and protest. We saw, you know, those walkouts, right? Those were beautiful, right? And I mentors a few kids from Poly who are Black, and you know they go in and support Latino initiatives, and then they also Latinos come and support their initiatives, and they were cross pollinating in terms of being active and demonstrating for equal and fair treatment of people of color, but also the lack of resources that were available within the schools.
So I know that, you know, every year there's efforts to protest the budget cuts to the city schools, and I mean, I don't know. I don't pretend to have the answers, but I think there's what happens when people are just beat down year after year after year. I think there's just an exhaustion point, and there's a women's demonstration. It's either today or tomorrow, but it's coming up this week, and the school funding is one of the issues, and it'll be big. It'll be a big rally. But I think, you know, as I watch and I look at the issues around the schools, it's so complicated. It's not linear. It's sort of all over the place, these funding calculations. Buzzy Heddleman, who always is saying, you know, more money and explaining the funding and let's change the funding diagrams. But it's not a simple issue. Like, you know, we can easily organize and say, listen, there should be no Muslim ban. That's easy. Easy to rally against, easy to rebel against. Stop ICE and these random pickups and this massive pickup of people, an easy issue. School funding, well, you know, the student population has dropped, the schools aren't full, you know, people are moving out of the city, the budget, we get more. You know, there's so many complicated factors that go into it, and I think maybe that's why people aren't massively protesting, added to the fact that there are massive protests on so many other issues.
Luis, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that we need to also think about in taking account here. I think, sure, the budget is not a simple issue, but it's definitely a question of priorities. Because if the city can find enough money to give tax breaks to big developers that are not bringing any good jobs back to Baltimore, that are not really invested in Baltimore, that are not paying taxes to Baltimore, and then we have a problem. See, if they can find money to do that, but not to fund schools, then it's a question of priorities. And I think that is part of the problem that we need to also be thinking and pushing or pushing the city to do what is the right thing for their people and not just for big developers. I mean, development, it has to happen, but what is the benefit for our communities, right? Like the casino was built under the idea that, and the assumption that the city schools will receive more money.
False assumption.
Well, it's not happening, right? It's not happening, and we knew that at the time there was a lot of stories and there was a lot of things that were saying this probably won't happen, and we knew that won't happen, and did not happen. So I think it's important for us to think about priorities, to think about, like, well, what are the city priorities? And how can we change that? How can we push them to put people from Baltimore first and not just keep with this trickle-down economics of, like, if we keep giving money to these big corporations, eventually everybody else will get something, right? Because we haven't seen this, that it doesn't work. It's not really helping. So I think that's important for us to question priorities and organize people around how do we change priorities in the city? How do we make the city think differently, right? And put the priorities in the right place. That's for one. And then second, I think it's important for us to think when we talk about the unity or the lack of unity, sometimes among different groups. I think it's important for us to also remember that to question first why that disunity exists, right? Why we have been to fight against each other, right? Like when we talk about African American community and Latino community, we actually, and the workplaces, we work together. You know, like if you go to a restaurant, you will find a lot of Latinos and African Americans working together in the kitchen. And I think it's important for us to remember that a lot of the disunity, it has been because, in one way or other, socially we have been manipulated to fight for crumbles. You know, like, I want this job that is $8 per hour, but then this person is taking my job that is also making $8 per hour. You know, like, it's like the needs, like the immediate needs are always difficult. And I think now that, now more than ever, we need to remember, the words of MLK, when he said that we need to come together, you know, and we need to organize revolutions against injustice, not against the life of people, you know, but against injustice, against the structures that where society has been failing to actually eliminate poverty, to actually address these issues. Like, this is the moment, and I think, like, it's we have been, you know, there is the importance of why, you know, I work into a lot of leadership development, because it's important for people to understand, oh, why I'm fighting for crumbles? why I'm picking this other person as my enemy versus the larger structure that is keeping both of us oppressed? And that, I think that is key in this conversation.
I do, Jonah. That would be a good conversation, kind of really push us here in the air. Let me open the phones here and come over to Dana at 410-319-8888. And Michael, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Michael, you there? Yeah, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, first I'm going to speak about the blacks and Hispanics. You know, I'm 60 years old. I remember growing up watching black men, you know, standing on certain corners looking for odd jobs to support their families. You know, I see the same thing with Hispanic men at Home Depot and certain other places. They're trying to support their families. I totally understand that. I also remember how, growing up, you know, you had your whole family in the house, your grandmother, your grandfather. Everyone was in that one house. You know, we all are so similar that I can't see anybody disliking any blacks, disliking Hispanics for any reason, except for, you might have a language barrier, but that's about it. But we are, to me, we are one. We are one of the same. You know, and one more thing, to your guest, the lady in the house,
Dana Moore.
The problem she had in the store with the lady, fussing out or whatever. You know, I really think she should have maybe showed her badge and explained to her. But that was a problem. That was a problem that could have been nipped in the bud, because once she would have embarrassed her, she would have never done that again. She would have never done that again.
And it was interesting because she at one point says to me, I'm a psychologist and you are taking sadistic pleasure in my discomfort. And I said, well, you're a horrible psychologist. You're also a narcissist. you started this. I'm the victim here. And I guess, you know, I will say I was stunned that this was happening. She even talked about the political climate. So it wasn't until I got back in my car that I put it all together, and the store manager approached and said, well, what's going on? And I, at that point, I had paid for my items. They were in my bag. I was walking out, and I just said, you know, there's a very upset psychologist who's not well today. She's upset because the store's crowded. She's upset because of the political environment. She's called me some dirty names. I think you should be careful as you approach her, because we don't know what she might do. And I walked out. Mm. We've always, you know, in African American community, I was grew up thinking of Latino as our brown brothers and sisters. My first real boyfriend, and I hope my husband's not listening.
He'll
probably
get over it.
Is. My first real boyfriend was Hispanic. He was actually from his family was from Spain, so I learned Spanish and I never felt like there was much of a divide, you know, between us. He ended up owning a bicycle shop in Washington, D.C. Santiago Cejas Gonzalez is his name. I've always thought we were united. We don't talk about the liquor board a lot, but one of the things that we've done, we've seen more Latino business owners coming in for violations, and we don't want that. So we have hired a Latino inspector. We've started a program of going into the Latino business community to educate about the liquor laws because we care. We don't want people in trouble. There needs to be more of that.
And I think in some ways, what Luis was saying about people kind of fighting over crumbs because of the low wages that many African-American workers and Latino workers in the city live on, which is nothing, live on very little money, less than minimum wage, and struggling to survive with their families. Which is, you know, when I heard from friends who knew the man who ICE had stopped in the streets of Baltimore, and literally, if you folks don't know this story, it happened just a few days ago, a Honduran man who was a business owner and a community leader was sitting in his car, I think it was 2 o'clock in the morning, with a friend, a woman who was from Guatemala. They came and surrounded the car. They lied and said that they were city police at first, pulled him out of the car, then took him away and telling him, you know, Trump is now president and it's a different day and, you know, we're coming after you. And he's now in the one of the holding cells in Frederick, which we talked about last week in this program. But that, to me, in some ways, you know, Edgar, should be a line and sign for unity between Latinos and black community and the rest of us in this city to say that's not acceptable in Baltimore.
Yeah. You know,
there's nothing we can do legally to stop them. Because ICE has this federal authority, but I mean to stand up in kind of unity and protection.
Yeah, I mean, you look at who's incarcerated, right? Not, you know, a side of the note of ICE, right? It's usually brown bodies who are populating our cells. And we got to ask ourselves why, right? Why is this happening, and how can we work as a whole, not just to avoid this, but to question and to, you know, ask our governors, ask our mayors, ask our, you know, current president, you know, let's stop this. And it's not a new question. It's not a, you know, new issue. And then we look at the detention centers, right? To me, they're not detention centers, right? They're concentration camps, right? You are holding families, in essence. You're holding children. You're holding families, right? And these are concentration camps, and we need to call them the way they are, right? And we have them everywhere, right? They're not just here in Maryland. They're not new, right? They've been around for a while. And this, you know, it is sad, the story that you brought up, but it's not the first and it's not the last. And I think people...
And it won't be the last right now.
Yeah,
right.
And people need to realize that, right? The fact that these illegal illegally detaining people has been happening for years, and we need to step up our organizing and just calling it out, right? As we were talking about, for me, I use working with kids and as an educator, I use art as a way to talk about history. Right, we need to understand the fact that brown and black people have been uniting for years. Right, there was illegal deportations of Mexicans in the early 1900s, and there's a really famous picture of this Mexican holding up a sign, "Stop illegal deportations." Right, we need to look at, you know, why were zoot suits so popular in the black and Latino community. We need to look at, you know, why was the brown berets and the Black Panthers kind of separated, right? Why were they targeted? Why don't, you know, they still exist, but why aren't they as prominent as they were, you know, at their peak? We need to look at, you know, the fact that MLK and Cesar Chavez were talking and dealing with these issues in terms of, yeah, you need to attack them locally, and we're all doing our share, but we need to educate our young people the things that they're not learning in the schools, the fact that it's not new what they're seeing. And the fact that we need to come together. We need to come together. Yeah, we need to learn our history and learn why the U.S. has always been brown and will continue to be brown, right? And my existence is a form of resistance, in essence, right? Since Christopher Columbus landed in this so-called new land, I have been labeled as other and as not needed, right? And I am proud of to be part of this indigenous diaspora and this African diaspora. And I get labeled as Latino, but I am Afro-Indigenous and Spanish.
important, well said. And I think that, you know, one of the things that you look back in the 60s, I'm going to come right back to you, Louise, after we open this, get this next caller in, that you mentioned the Brown Berets, and that was a period of time when Poor People's Campaign that King started, Resurrection City, where Black, Latino, Native, and white people who were all living in poverty came together as a statement. It was also a time when the Brown Berets in Chicago, the Brown Berets, the young who were Mexican-American, Chicanos,
and the
Young Lords who were Puerto Ricans, and African-Americans with the Black Panthers, led by the Black Panthers, and the Young Patriots who were Appalachian and Southern whites, all came together in this unity. And there's a reason why King and I think Malcolm were taken out. They were moving into this direction of saying we have to have this unity. And that unity was destroyed by Nixon and others in a very – all the paperwork's all right there about how they saw this as a danger and had to stop it. And we got to figure out how to get back to it.
Exactly.
So to bring that back together. So, Luis, I want to come to you, but let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Luis, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, Luis. Welcome.
I'm sorry. I apologize if this has already been mentioned.
No, go ahead. What is it?
I wanted to let everyone know that there is a protest scheduled in Annapolis this Thursday about the school budget cuts. I don't know all the details because I'm just finding out myself, which is part of the problem. And I know that some buses are leaving from schools. I know there's some buses leaving from Poly. I don't know about the other schools. But part of the problem is that the word isn't getting out. You know, it should be all over the place, the news, radio, newspapers, everything. And we need to be more proactive rather than reactive. And, you know, that, you know, we know these things are coming. Yet we wait till the last minute to start, you know, trying to do something about it. So that's all I wanted to say.
Louise, thanks for calling. No, I appreciate that. And tomorrow we're actually going to have an entire hour on the school budget crisis here in Baltimore City to try to get people moving on this, because it's a kind of a crime what we're doing to our children here in the city with that budget cut that should not be allowed. Our kids need more, not less, in a city like this. So thank you for that call, and we'll check out what's happening Thursday and put that and promote that. 410-319-8888 is a number here. Luis, did you want to jump in and say something there quickly before we go back? Luis is gone. 410-319-8888. Come back to your calls in just a minute. So you know, this is so. Well, I don't know. I haven't heard about what's happening Thursday, and we'll find that out.
Trying to find out.
And then on that note, on this coming Monday, CASA is organizing a demonstration in Annapolis as well to call our legislative to support the Trust Act. And part of the Trust Act is to really push, this sanctuary spaces, right? What's happening right now with our undocumented brothers and sisters, what's happening, you know, they're being targeted. ICE knows that they're going in, you know, maybe to a court or maybe at their, at their house, more specifically the courts, at least for me, then that's a significant thing, right? They're going in to be, you know, productive parts of society, you know, paying their taxes and, you know, showing up to court dates. If you want to come out and support our efforts, come out on Monday to Annapolis. I think there's buses leaving.
This coming Monday, a week from today?
A week from today. They'll be leaving. I think there's a few buses. One I know is leaving from CASA on Fayette. There's another one leaving and Patterson Park. But you're more than welcome just to show up. And I think it's from, I believe it's from 7 till 10, I think, in Annapolis. Just reach out to CASA. And, yeah, if you're really interested in and doing a lot of direct action with us. I say us because I'm a volunteer there. There's a lot of work to do. And I kind of echo what our previous caller was saying, right? I think a lot of our communities, both the Black and, you know, other marginalized communities, we kind of react really spontaneously sometimes, and yeah, that's good. But then there's also other organizations that are doing really great stuff, and I think we need to just not add to what people are already doing, but support it. And I think that's what we need to do more of.
I just found the information on the school rally in Annapolis. It's this Thursday. Buses are leaving from Waverly Elementary at 4:30 p.m. Good news, bad news, the buses are full. So there is clearly great response. But they're offering people to carpool, follow behind the bus.
This Thursday at what time?
Bus is leaving from Waverly Elementary School at or Elementary Middle at 4:30 p.m.
Rush hour.
Rush hour, Ellerslie Avenue.
That's good, that's good. So, and who's organizing it?
I'm not sure who's organizing it. I got this from Strong City.
Okay.
It certainly is one of the folks involved. Let me see. And I got Amy Harmon Darrow invited me.
Okay.
Yep.
So, and going on, wait, Luis, you still with us? Luis, Lorraine?
Yep.
So we had a tweet in from Melissa. Why does our city think this is okay? 23 out of 24 jurisdictions on school spending. We have a caller who wants to state that people can go to the Baltimore Teacher United website for buses at 5 p.m. So if you go to Baltimore Teacher United website, you'll find out more about Thursday as well, with other buses leaving that they're working on. Baltimore Teacher United leaving at 5 p.m. on Thursday as well. So, Luis, I'm sorry. I thought for some reason I thought you weren't there. I apologize. So, why don't you leap in on what you just heard with your comment?
I think of course it's important for us to react, but I agree we need to be very proactive too. You know, and I think that just speaks back to what I was saying. And like, how do we organize people for the long term in terms of like thinking about the structure, thinking about the systems, thinking about like what are the long-term changes that we have to do and we need to fight for, you know, like as I would say, that's why when we talk about priorities, right, like what is the city's priorities is to bring ICE and terrorize immigrant communities, or is to violently treat people in less poor communities, or is to actually lift the lives of people that live in Baltimore. And that those priorities won't come just because. They will come only if we organize, if we educate, if we develop leaders that are ready to keep fighting. You know, I'm happy that you bring up the Push People's campaign, because it's one of those moments where people were getting together and were thinking about, like, What are the long-term solutions, right? Like when MLK said, he was pretty much calling for a restructure in the economic and political system. And we're talking about power at the end of the day, right? Like the reason why this community, our communities are always attacked is because are perceived as powerless. But we have a lot of political power that we can really push and direct in ways that we actually can change what is politically possible, that we can change the political agenda, you know, and I think that's key. That's really important that when we think proactively, we are thinking, if we think about like long-term solutions too, you know, but those long-term solutions and that understanding is not easy to come to actually understand, you know, because there's a structure that has been put in place for a while, for years and years and years, for decades. So it's difficult to try to navigate the system, to change that, and to actually make something that would be good for all of us.
So we have like 3 or 4 minutes left. So go ahead, Dana, then come back to Edgar.
I guess my thought is, if ever there was a time to organize together, it's now. And if just looking at the Women's March, say what you want about it, but there was a small idea of just getting together for a small demonstration, and it went global. Many, 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 many millions showed up. I don't particularly like the saying, if you build it, they will come, but I believe if someone were to organize a gathering of brown people and black people, it would be overwhelming, and ideas would come, and commitments would be made.
Edgar? Here's your thoughts on how this grows. Listen to what Dana was saying. Listen to what Luis was saying, and how this actually
how does it happen?
How does it happen?
Luis, we're looking at you.
Edgar.
Let me
jump in. Luis, we haven't heard from Edgar anymore. Let me just jump to Edgar before we.
Yeah, I think we need to understand the power of social media, and the fact that we have young people who are very excited to jump on board and step up to be leaders. And I think we need to look to them and to really engage them and foster a very meaningful way of organizing, a very structured way of creating change, and not just think, you know, let's just go out and organize, but let's think the long term, right? How can we really make large systematic change in our organization or in our institutes that are, you know, basically set up to oppress our communities, right? And we see that. I think we're seeing it with a lot of young people who are looking to other organizations to really provide them with that training. And I think we need to continue doing that. But we need to be open to stepping back, as you know, as I say, us, meaning like me as a person who's organizing and helping people, you know, call others. We need to support our young people, and we need to understand the power of social media. I mean, we look at our actions we did on Sunday, me and a group of friends, and you know, within 12 hours, we had, you know, close to 400 people show up.
At Patterson Park.
So, you know, that's, you know, 20-something, 30-somethings. But we think of, you know, 16-year-olds and, you know, in their teens, you know, they have tons of people following them. So I'm thinking, how can we continue to this conversation, not just in the city, but like you said, nationally, globally, and the fact that there are brown people all throughout the world who are marginalized and are oppressed. And sometimes they might be the ones in power, sometimes they're not, but a lot of times we feel powerless.
I'm going to first thank Edgar Reyes for joining us, full-time teacher, artist, and activist. His website is full of his story, being undocumented and where and who he is now. Luis Arena is leadership organizer for United Workers. Dana Moore is an attorney, community activist, member of the Silica Board, former chair of the City Ethics Board. Thank all of you so much for being part of this conversation today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We take a short break, and we're going to have a debate on boycott and divestment in the state legislature. And then we meet Dr. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, talk about her book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of the Runaway Slave Owner Judge, to celebrate President's Day. Stay with us. We'll be back.